This is a Dauntless Media Collective podcast. Visit dauntless.fm for more content.
Are you an alumnus of an evangelical college or university? Or have you ever wondered what attending or working at one of those schools is like? The Chapel Probation Podcast brings you the stories from students, faculty, and administration who experienced all the racism, the queerphobia, the misogyny, and purity culture weirdness that are kind of the hallmarks of these schools. I'm Scott Okamoto, author of Asian American Apostate, Losing Religion and Finding Myself at an Evangelical University, which tells my story of teaching English at an evangelical school and realizing I didn't believe in God or the Bible anymore. I created Chapel Probation as a complement to my book, but this podcast has become its own community of people who have stories of hurt and pain and stories of triumph during and after their time at evangelical schools. Some of the guests you've probably heard of, but most of them you probably haven't. But all the stories are incredible examples of surviving Christian schools and finding ourselves. You can find Chapel Probation wherever you listen to podcasts, and I hope you'll join us.
All right.
Okay. Welcome to the Thereafter Podcast, a place where we explore life on the other side of faith change.
We're here to break down the binaries, deconstruct the dualities, and wander through what it looks like to live in the gray.
In church, we were told that life after leaving would be a bitter wasteland of unfulfilling hedonism, but we've discovered quite the opposite.
There's actually a vibrant community of people on the other side of faith who are finding and co-creating space for hope and healing.
Come along as we explore the all too often uncharted expanse of evangelicalism, evolving faith, and the life thereafter. Hey, hey!
Another episode of the Thereafter Podcast. Your hosts, Cortland and Megan here. Hi, Megan.
Hey. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. I ran a really long Ethernet cord up into my office through my stairwell at my house to be as connected to the internet as I could to record this today, and it feels great.
And you're rocking the man bun. Is that an accurate depiction?
Yeah, man bun, top knot.
There you go.
More of a boy bun. Boy with an I, B-O-I, boy bun. But yeah, I really like it. However, my barber, the last time I got a haircut, like edged up the line a little funny so that I do have these like tiny little baby hairs that won't go up, that aren't, that just kind of stick out, which I don't know. I don't know what he was doing. I got to go back and get it fixed.
You could probably solve that with like gel or something.
I could. I could probably get my beard trimmer and go at it, but like I am like even very careful about my beard because I just don't have steady hands. It's one of the reasons that I don't wear eye makeup more regularly, because like I would love to embrace like the aspect of kind of like gender bending that like kind of I feel on the inside, but the two things that stop me is one, like effort, and two, like steadiness of hand. Like I just don't think that I can. Last time I put on eyeliner, it was like a very fraught experience of like almost poking my eye out and lots of squiggly lines. Do you wear eye makeup, Megan?
I do. I wear eyeliner and mascara. But it's funny you say that because my 11-year-old is starting to get into makeup and had me put eyeliner on her, and it was like a liquid pencil, and you have to be solid and straight. I mean, I have pretty steady hands and I still couldn't do it exactly, and especially on somebody else. I can do it on myself, but yeah, it's a talent.
Yeah. Yeah. I need to just work on it more. It's the effort thing for me too. I was telling my partner the other day that like I think I would, if I enjoyed shopping more, I would dress way gayer. Like I always see Not that like you have to dress gay to like be gay or whatever, like queerness isn't an aesthetic, et cetera, all the disclaimers. But like I see shit online and I'm like, I want to wear a crocheted rainbow jumpsuit. Like, but like, how do I find it? Where do I like, yes. How do I get it in my size? And so I end up wearing a gray t-shirt and jeans every day because it's like, I know the jeans that fit and a gray t-shirt's always going to look, you know, the way it looks.
There you go.
So
there you go.
Anyway, that was not a planned portion of the intro today, but that's where we got.
Yeah, we're good. We have a guest that we're going to introduce. There's a couple things we want to talk about real quick. I guess we never really found another title besides Twitbits.
I'm back on Twitter now, so fuck it. We're Twitbits. It is.
There we go. It can kind of be a fuck you to calling it X. So it'll be like a throwback.
Throwback edition.
Twitbits.
What are we talking about, Megan?
Well, there was a lot of dialogue about the Reformation Project this week. And if you're not familiar, there's Matthew Vines, who wrote God and the Gay Christian about the clobber passages, has been controversial amongst queer Christians, I would say. Queer Christians, right? I mean, wouldn't you say that's kind of who his target audiences, and he created the organization, the Reformation Project. And but he sent out, you said it was in an email, right?
Yeah, it was an email. And then I think maybe the archive of the email got posted to their blog or something. I eventually did see like a link to a webpage that had the text from it. But I believe that the original text was in an email, I think directly from Matthew Vines. And I don't know if it was prompted by something. But it was like pretty obviously trying to like delineate themselves from the like political left and like make sure that they were being clear that they had not been co-opted by queer theory and did not support queer theology, but rather firmly embraced and affirmed the sanctity and authority of scripture and the affirming theology that can be clearly and objectively reasoned from that authoritative scripture that they affirm and believe in. Right. So it was like, it felt very just like the Gospel Coalition does like gay. like
it's evangelicalism for gay people.
Yes.
And just gay people. Like, it feels like, when you think about the inclusivity of the LGBTQ plus, all of the letters in that acronym even extends. When you think about that, I feel like Matthew Vines actively works to shrink that acronym into just a few letters, right? Like, I don't think he's inclusive of all of the queer identities. We've probably talked about it on the podcast because he has a fierce stance against non-monogamy, and he also still holds to the ethic that you should be abstinent until you're married. So there's so many things that are still rooted in purity culture, but it's kind of the
and whiteness. Part of
and whiteness, yes.
Very much so.
But it's like what we were trying to combat at Content Warning by being able to elevate all these different, you know, non-monogamy, sex work, ethical porn, all of those different pieces. And he's like, no. I mean, anytime you see someone say that objectively and authoritatively, this is the clear stance, biblical stance, it's like, that's already a red flag no matter what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm obviously kind of paraphrasing. You know, definitely go look it up. Maybe I'll try to find whoever archived the text and put it in the show notes. But I remember one piece of it was he said something about, like, we, you know, actively reject the idea that of queerness that just stands for anything that is non-normative, right? This kind of idea that in their view, gay and lesbian people need to not get wrapped up in this idea of queerness that can just be this broad catch-all for anything that's non-normative. When in reality, like, that is the beautiful expanse of the rainbow, like of queerness, of all of the identities that fall under the LGBTQ plus IA 2S acronym, right? Ever expanding, is that the entire reality of what unifies us as a group of people is the idea that it is non-normative, the idea that it is counter the white Euro-colonial ideal for human relationship. And that bears itself out throughout lots of scripture, which is why queer theology, much of which influenced and found its way into Matthew Vine's own work, is what it is, right? And so, like, he can't separate himself out. It feels very much like just trying to, I don't know, it's got a lot of pick me energy. It's got a lot of like, we want,
it's respectability politics.
Exactly.
It's hey, you can be gay as long as you do it like the straights, right? And it's, hey, you can be part of the church as long as you don't seem like you're too far out of the edge. It's kind of, to me, here's what I think. I feel like for a long time, people that were divorced were kind of like shunned from the church. And now everyone's gone through this like, hey, let's, you know, and probably because like the pastors were getting divorced, you know, like they're like, hey, okay, actually we changed our stance, right?
Yeah, the
and
tithers, the major like, tithers were getting divorced. That's the big, that's the big fucking deal.
Exactly. And now it's like, okay, we have some gay people that actually don't cause too many problems. So let's just, and there's, you know, they still hold to purity culture and they're not, you know, they don't make us think too much outside of our own narrow worldview. And so we're just going to kind of create this new box that people can fit in and make it pretty containing, but a little bit bigger than the old box. And I mean, it's just a new version of the old stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it is this rigidity, it's this binary, it's this obsession with objectivity, and it really is a fundamental misunderstanding of queerness as a whole, right? I mean, it's the reason why I won't say this person by name, but I have a former pastor friend who came out late in life and since has become a pretty, at least at one point when I unfollowed or blocked on platforms, became a pretty vocal anti-trans voice. And and you're like, what? Like, how did you do like 15, 20 years in the closet as a pastor and then come out and marry a man and then you're going to perpetuate anti-trans talking points as a white cis gay man? Like you totally missed your entire experience. Like you totally missed the point of, you know, like you are so hung up on your privilege and your supremacy. And yeah, I mean, the conversation about the privilege still held by cis white gay men is a difficult conversation, but one that must be had. And Matthew Vines, I think, is a great example of that.
Yeah. And I do think there's a piece, and this might get us into a new topic here, but I think there's a piece of naming that privilege when, I mean, we've talked about atheists and how they can still cause harm on the other side of things. And we've talked about, I mean, people know feminists, TERFs, like that. Like, there's still people that I feel like leverage a marginalized identity, but then yet once there starts to be some privilege within that, start to cause harm. And I know it was interesting because I had a tweet this week. I think it was yesterday. I had some, a real visceral, just negative interaction that had been really targeted to me that left me pretty upset. It was really personal, and it was about me being bi, and somebody had some really nasty things to say about that. And when I tweeted about it, I'll just say the tweet. I said, I recognize that bisexuality comes with privilege, especially the ability to pass as straight and choose whether to navigate spaces openly or closeted. But today I experienced hate directly targeted at me explicitly for being bi in an extremely personal way. And it was hard. And the thing that was interesting was there were people on Twitter that were kind of upset with me for naming the privilege or trying to say, like, you don't have to do that, or you don't. And I was, my reaction was like, I didn't do that because I thought I had to do it. I did it because that's what I believe to be true. And I'm not trying to, you know, weaken my story or, you know, do something else, but I'm just trying to express, like, I even said on Twitter, like, one of the reasons that it was so emotional for me was because it was completely unexpected and I'm not used to experiencing that level of hate. And in order, like, I feel like I see that through the lens of, like, I have trans friends that can't safely use the restroom, and we have Black friends that can't drive in a car safely without worrying about getting pulled over just for being Black. And so it's important to me to have that juxtaposition, to recognize, like, half the reason that this was such a hard experience was because it was surprising to me. And that the reason, like, me experiencing hate as a surprise is privilege, because I don't see that on a day-to-day basis in the same way that other folks with marginalized identities do experience that regularly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that when we talk about things like privilege, we have to realize that there isn't a singular binary perspective, viewpoint, vantage point, definition about these things, right? And I think that that's when people bring up the idea of bi privilege, right? Which specifically said that way, I do understand where the visceral reaction, like, oh, there isn't bi privilege. You don't have bi privilege, because there is a lot of things that come along with bisexuality in terms of bi erasure and a lack of acceptance by both the straight community and many gay communities, dating in a world where now both groups of people have reason to be suspect or hold you at arm's length. Like, there are disadvantages, I guess, if we're going to say about that reality and that identity. However, there are also, in some context, through some vantage points, benefits, like privileges, right? Like, when you are in a heterosexual passing relationship, there is privilege that comes with that. There is privilege that comes with being, you know, passable with a binary gender, right? Like, there, like, it doesn't mean that binary transness is somehow, you know, privileged, but there are privileges that come with certain realities. You know, the fact that I, previous to 2014 or whenever the landmark Supreme Court ruling, I could marry my partner that I'm married to because it wasn't illegal, right? I, like, that is a privilege that I have. And so, like, I just think that oftentimes when we get into these conversations, there is a lack of, like, discussion around the nuance of these things and the importance of talking about where my areas of privilege overlap with areas of marginalization. And
yeah, and I,
go ahead.
That came up on that thread too, because somebody said, where you said privilege, I would call that erasure, like bi erasure. But it was really like you just really spoke, I think, well to both sides of it, because then other people were like, it's kind of both and, because you can benefit from the privilege of being able to be straight passing in certain settings where you then don't experience that same level of targeted marginalization or hate. But also there is an element of erasure that happens when you are straight passing and then people make assumptions and have misconceptions of, about you. And so, but it felt important to me because I feel like I feel that in my bones, because I do have close friends that experience the world a lot differently than me, and I see it through that lens. And so I did want to name that. And I also think about I think about a lot of people that I know that are non-monogamous, that so many people are closeted when they're non-monogamous, because even if people that they're in social circles with accept their maybe queer identity, if they're bi or if they're gay or lesbian, like or trans, then if sometimes non-monogamy is like, well, I don't know. That's a little. It's kind of like what we talked about, a content warning. And so I also see that there's ways that people have to navigate to really kind of blend in, or maybe are forced to navigate to blend in. And so there's just a lot happening there that I just wanted to express. It's complicated.
It's complicated. And we've talked about this before with other guests. And I think we maybe had a conversation with Benji about this, whether it was on stage, a content warning or not. I don't remember, but we get into these like oppression Olympics types of situations where it's like, oh, well, the disadvantage that comes with this identity is greater than the disadvantage that comes with this identity, and this identity can be hidden and this identity cannot be. I do get that. Like, I think we get that. And I think that we do need to do active work to end the types of bi erasure that go, hey, you don't have to talk about your bisexuality all the time. You're dating someone of the opposite gender. Just like those of us over here in this other camp are facing actual oppression and you're not really. And so you need to check your bi privilege. Like that framing can be harmful, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as a bisexual person saying, hey, I want to acknowledge that my experience has been privileged in certain ways because of how my identity gets expressed in culture, and that has resulted in a very different experience for me, especially as a cis white person who presents their gender or performs their gender in this certain way, et cetera. Whatever additional complexities you want to add to that, we need to be careful to not jump on those people and go, you're doing a bi erasure, you know? Like, it's like, yeah. No, they're trying to hold their position within the greater context of human flourishing with nuance and with, you know, awareness that there's way more than their experience. And again, I don't know if I want to bring this up. It's one of the things that I've talked about on this podcast before. I follow a lot of very fierce advocates for trans healthcare who are doing that from a position of detransition or retransition. There's some new language around retransition. And I think a lot of times those folks do have some really important perspective on how them trying to live out their reality of being detrans for whatever reason, they are then used as pawns this kind of war over who's going to, you know, get their say respected. And I think bisexual folks oftentimes do end up as that kind of pawn also between these communities of, you know, straight people tend to use bisexual people in various different ways. Straight men have used bisexual women in a lot of ways throughout culture that have been super harmful. There's a lot of fear of dating someone who's bisexual in queer monosexual communities. And also that impacts the way a trans non-binary person just navigates any relationship, right? Because if somebody is not fitting into these super binary genders, they can very quickly become or feel excluded from any of these super binary communities. So it's just complicated.
Yeah, and I think I'm so glad you brought in the broader perspective. I also, it was just interesting to me because there was a lot of support after I tweeted that out. But like in that moment, it felt like people were trying to like I'm like explaining a moment where I had experienced hurt, and people were like, maybe you shouldn't have framed it that way. And I was like trying, like it was just interesting to have that be the response. And I also, just to kind of bring it back, and I know we want to get into our interview, to Matthew Vines, I had an interaction with somebody that was trying to defend Matthew Vines in that whole thing. And they were, their bio said they were progressive. They went to a queer affirming church. And the interesting thing about that interaction is you could tell, I think it was a woman, you could tell she had not listened to the queer community at all. And she had not even paid attention to the Reformation Project at all, because she was saying, like, I haven't seen them say anything about non-monogamy. And if, are you saying that if I'm uncomfortable with non-monogamy, that now you cancel me? And it was like, that's not even what we're saying at all. You don't have to be non-monogamous to be able to appreciate other people's agency and autonomy. And on top of that, forget all the bad theology that Matthew Vines has. We know people that have worked for the Reformation Project that say he's an awful, terrible leader. Like, he's just not a great person also. And so there's that added layer of the way that he runs organizations is problematic. So there's a lot happening there.
Yeah. Well, and it comes back around to another thing we talked about at Content Warning of, like, we have to be willing to acknowledge that there is problematic forces at play within our marginalized communities. There are people who are non-monogamous who are taking advantage of, again, bisexual folks who are doing unicorn hunting, who are doing you know, and unethical in the ethical non-monogamy world. They're harming people. There are, I mentioned my former friend who is a gay man who is doing harm to the trans community. Like we cannot just go like, oh, well, you know, we're going to cover up what they did, the bad thing, the harm that they caused, because we'd rather, you know, talk about the harm that the straight people are doing or that the monogamous people are doing or whatever. Like wherever the harm is happening, we have to talk about it, and we have to address it, even if it's coming from inside the house.
Yeah, and because if we cover up people that are causing harm because of those reasons, we're back to what happened in evangelicalism, where people were abusive, and then they were like, everyone's reaction would be like, well, we can't have this be public because, quote, they've been such a great person, or they've done such good work that would then damage the work that they're doing. And it's like, no, they're causing harm. That needs to be named, and they need to be held accountable. So
preach. Who's our interview with today, Megan?
Brandon Flannery, who I felt so bad when we jumped into the interview. You hear me say, I hear you have a book coming out. It's been out.
It's out.
Go order Brandon's book. You'll listen to it. You'll love Brandon. We love Brandon. We got to know him, and I've him and I go back a little bit further, but I picked up a copy of his book at Content Warning because David Morris was there with his books. Ooh. And I'm excited to read it, and I know you'll love it, and let's get into it.
Let's do it. Brandon Flannery, everybody. Alrighty.
Another episode of the Thereafter Podcast. Welcome back.
With your hosts, Megan Crozier, and myself, Cortland Coffey, and a guest today.
We have Brandon Flannery with us. Welcome, Brandon. Say hi.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks, y'all. Excited to have a little chit chat.
Yeah.
I am excited because you remember we Zoomed once, right?
Yeah, we did. Yeah. Like way back. I want to say like a year and a half, 2 years ago now.
Yeah. And now, look, fast forward, you have a book deal and you have a book coming out. What? Tell us.
That's out,
well,
right?
Okay. Isn't the book out? I don't want to get ahead of myself.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's out. We got the hardcover out in August. Paperback launched in November, and then audiobook was December. So, yeah, it's been a whirlwind. It's been super crazy. So, yeah, it is finished, as someone might say.
Well, I want to get into all that book stuff, but I also want to hear a little bit of the context of kind of your story and everything. So let's, if you want to just tell us a little bit about kind of what brand of evangelicalism were you?
I've been using the word flavor for some reason. Mm. I don't know why, but like anytime someone is like, oh yeah, I'm Christian, I'm like, what flavor Christian are you? Because it also tells me what flavor trauma they likely have.
Yeah.
I was raised evangelical, non-denominational, like charismatic, but like I would say not quite Bethel level, but pretty close. Like I feel like Bethel was the lemon pepper seasoning that you'd incorporate into some meal, spiritual meal, so to speak,
wow,
but it wasn't like the
speaking my language.
Typical, it was just like a spice though that you'd like kind of bring in there. Maybe you'd go to a conference here or there, get really inspired and go back to your not as charismatic space. But like, I mean, on a Sunday morning, you would hear tongues, you would hear, you'd see flaggers. Wouldn't get like a ton of like you'd sometimes get some prophetic words, but like it was an approved person who was like on a certain team. It was a mega church. So I grew up at New Life.
Oh.
In Colorado Springs, Colorado. Okay. So like, yeah.
That
there you go.
I get it. I went
we can just expedite it at this point.
I grew up Southern Baptist, but I had a brief affair with a charismatic church that was a church plant of New Life in the Kansas City, Kansas area. So it was Life Church, Kansas.
Oh, which one?
Life Church, Olathe. Clint Sprague.
Who was the pastor?
Sprague, I believe, was the pastor at the time. Okay. And my youth pastor there was Jared Schultz. Shout out to Jared Schultz. He got me hooked on Diet Coke and emo music. I along with the trauma, I owe him a big bill for a lot of things that he got me into. Up until that point, I had no idea the Holy Spirit existed. And then someone brought me to that youth group that was a New Life plant. And I was like, holy shit, there's like a whole other side to this thing.
Did you guys have your mosh pit of righteousness there as well?
We did.
Nice.
We did. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but I have to ask about the approved person that could give the prophetic word, because I it's just funny to me that the whole concept of prophecy and all of that has just kind of gone. There's like prophetic influencers, and there's people who, you know, there's people from Bethel that I would say were complicit in January 6th because of their prophetic, you know, following and quote unquote. But so at New Life, they're like, okay, but we actually have the prophecy market cornered. Is that kind of what the vibe was? Like, what is that?
I mean, kind of. I mean, it was a big church at its apex. I want to say it was 15,000 when I was before Ted decided to hire a man and have an affair. So, and then the crumbling, and then a shooting, and then lots of other stuff. So, but at its apex, I want to say it was 15,000, and then the youth group was easily 1,500, and that's just high school. I think part of it was you can't just have a ton of people running up trying to grab the microphone from this massive congregation. So like there are familiar faces that had built rapport. It's not like you went through a class or anything like that, or it's like you just had to know certain someone's. And then every so often, like if you were a familiar face, you could approach someone where you knew there was a microphone and they would listen to the prophecy first to kind of like check it. And then it's like, okay, maybe let's see if it fits in the order of service. But typically it would be like a rotating five people that it's like they had somehow built rapport with the pastors, had been there a while, and they know they're not going to say something super crazy. So then they'll be like, okay, you can grab the microphone. So yeah, what's interesting too is I saw once. What was the other one? It's Tongues and the Interpretation of Tongues. I saw that one time, but like, I think that's the craziest it got at ours. And just a lot of jumping during worship, a lot of white people dancing. Yeah. So
a lot of better is one day in this house. Better is one day.
Ours was because it was the church New Life wrote I Am Free, and who got famous for it? I'm trying to think of
Israel Houghton
who purchased the rights. Yeah, for Newsboys.
Was he?
Well, no. It was. We're both just silently like, I forget who it was, but it was John Egan that wrote that song in our church, and like we would lose our minds over it. And so when I Am Free became like a big deal, I think it was. Australia. Newsboys. I think it was Newsboys that maybe took it up.
Could have been.
I can't remember. But I got a big deal, and like we would lose our minds like dancing to that song. So.
So then, you know, you're in New Life, like, and now you're here. There had to have been kind of an in-between, right? Like,
one would hope, or maybe not. I guess, like, the biggest thing for me to say is I was really much so all in on evangelicalism, and I think that I fit the bill for someone who could be successful in that space. I'm white. I'm cis. My personality does decently well in that space, like charismatic enough, but also still want to impress people, you know? And so I think that, the mentality that was taught to me is someone who really loves Jesus. And of course I really want to love Jesus is going to like do full-time ministry or go become a missionary or like write important things or speak about important things. Like you can go get a normal job, but like, it's like second class. And so you really want to show how much you love God through your zeal and your, I would say, sacrifice. And so like there was this mentality of like, whatever I like, I should do the opposite. And it probably had something to do with the fact that I'm a queer person and like my body literally wanted something that was told was bad, told was evil, and witnessed firsthand like a leader who was found out and everything was taken from him. And like there was this like vivid example of this is what happens if you get found out. And so other than my queerness, I was all in. It gave me so much validation and purpose and belonging. And so I was going to stay with my church. We had this really intense post high school leadership academy, like all the charismatic non-denominational spaces do to get free labor. And it was called 24/7, and they had the cops called on lots of times. That's a whole nother thing. But it got canceled, and I was like, what's the next worst thing that I am terrified of that I can do? And so I picked Team Mania Ministries Honor Academy. So
you went to Honor Academy.
Of course you did.
We just did an episode about all, not Honor Academy specifically, but I brought it up a lot. But yeah, all of these leadership training programs prey on that 18 to 20 year old demographic of you don't need to go to college, come serve Jesus for free, or better yet, pay us.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, you get assigned jobs at the Honor Academy. And one of my jobs was that person where it'd be like, you don't know what to do? Come spend a year with us. It'd be great. You can spend a year figuring out what you want to do. Don't you want to give a year to God? What's 1 year in the scheme of your life? Like that was those are the taglines to get exactly to your point, not just free labor paying to work for you. So, yeah. Who did y'all cover? I'm just so curious with that episode. It was Team Mania and what other ones?
We talked about a lot of them. We talked about Rev 5. I don't know if you are familiar.
I actually don't know that one.
What was the one with Assemblies of God? Mission. I can't remember the name, but yeah.
We talked about YWAM.
That was another one I did.
Oh, you did a DTS?
You did both? Wow.
I told you I was in. So I, after my year, I was going to stay another year and tour at the Honor Academy. Like that's how much I loved it. And there was some, that's a whole nother episode. Like Honor Academy, there's a lot that happened there. A quick aside, I've been reconnected with some friends from there, and a lot of us have deconstructed. Some are still Christian, some are not. And I went to Dallas, Texas with my boyfriend, and it was just a surreal moment to be with these people who I had done a lot of crazy things in the name of God and would never imagine that they would want to meet my boyfriend and here they are. So that's like a quick, wow, really beautiful moment that happened this weekend.
That whole program is shut down, right? Like the Honor Academy doesn't exist anymore, yeah, correct? Or it's rebranded, I guess. Maybe it's something else.
It hasn't. Me and Ron Luce have talked in Facebook Messenger. I think he's trying to like still, I don't know what else he can do besides trying to go around and speak. That's really his gig. So I would imagine that he's still doing that. And like, he was trying to launch something. I don't know if I ever got off the ground, but in short, it closed down. They were granted that land by Keith Green. His widow granted it to Teen Mania. And so they had this property, gorgeous property out in West Texas. I want to say it was like 400 something acres. And they just defaulted on their taxes was part of it. And another part was Ron had purchased another ministry. And I don't know what the legal term for it is, but like that ministry loaned money it didn't have to Teen Mania to pay off all this debt it had. So he's like hiding debt. And eventually it caught up to him. And they went bankrupt. Yeah. So at one point they moved to Dallas. Like I think their last two dying years, cause they lost the property. I had a couple of friends that were part of that era. But it wound down, I want to say around 2014, 2015, like right in there. So, and I graduated from there in 2008, 2009.
Okay. Yeah.
It was my year that I was there. My
closest experience to that was my brother-in-law went there, and that was in 2004,
oh, wow,
I believe. 2005, 2004, 2005. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, so I'm sure you have plenty of stories.
I've heard every story from those couple years for sure.
Well, I just had a question because and I think that this isn't a question I would have asked maybe 2 years ago, but there's a hint of nostalgia here, right? And yeah, I think that there's absolutely this piece of like with a lot of our stories of healing and kind of coming out of this place that was our whole lives, whether it was in kind of that really intense high control environment or whether it was just being really involved in a church, and you have community and you have things. Yep. And I think that, you know, you go through these shifts when you're deconstructing, like, fuck all of it. It was all horrible. And I think that like after time and maybe some perspective, and maybe it was all horrible for people, I don't want to be prescriptive, but I do sense like a bit of nostalgia here. And I'm curious if that's something that you've had to sift through of like, maybe there were some things that were like good about it, or maybe there were some things that I gained from it that I carry now, but then now, you know, you have a new perspective also.
Yeah. I do think that it's important to go through the fuck all space, especially when it comes to an entity or a person or place or thing that is harming you and is causing harm. Like the X stage is so important. I was recently talking about my move to Atlanta with someone, and I was like, I heard this phrase growing up of make sure you're just running to, not from. I'm sure it was a Christian space that I heard that. And I actually don't agree with that anymore. If you're in a household where there's an abuser, it doesn't matter where you go, just get out of the house.
Yeah.
And so I think that for a lot of us, that stage is so important. And I think that our bodies are like, they're so beautiful in the sense of anger. Like all emotions are valid and important, neither good nor bad. And I've really come to befriend anger because it is the emotion that keeps us safe. It's the emotion that gives us power to run from a place of harm. It's the emotion that helps us form identity of here's where I stop and you begin. You don't have access past this point. It's super important. And now like, that's a whole nother podcast about anger, but like, I think it's so important to go into the X phase. But what I've been noticing is that not all the time. And I think that we can't dictate what that timeline looks like, but I have been noticing in a lot of these like ex-evangelical spaces that it's just the ex and it's just anger. And if you need that to be safe, I get it. And however long that's going to serve you, stay there and be angry and form boundaries and create distance. But what I found for myself, it has been that in the past, I was so sold out on evangelicalism that I felt like it was driving my life. And if whatever leader I was supposed to follow said turn right, I would turn right. And for years, out of this place of anger and pain and resentment, if I bumped into people that looked like that entity and they said, hey, I think you should turn right, like it, I think that would be a healthy choice for you, my immediate gut reaction would be like, no, and I'd turn left. Even if it would have been a healthy choice to like align with whatever they were, like friends, family were saying. I think that anger and love are actually pretty close neighbors. Like the best thing that I can do is come to a place of indifference and come to a place of healing where I can come across the street and get perspective. And that's where I feel where I'm at in my journey with that. And like, yeah, a nostalgia, but more than nostalgia, I think that, yes, nostalgia. And, I can hold both in my hand of, I had some beautiful moments and beautiful friends and some beautiful things happen and some rough things and things in between where I don't want to inherit a framework from evangelicalism that says I have to choose either or, that I have to live in black and white. But I actually even want to dismantle the framework I was given where I'm not saying you definitely have the wrong answers. I can even say, you know what, maybe there are some good things there and some good answers, but you don't have a monopoly on it. And so that's like the more important work for me now, where it's like I do want to incorporate some things. I think there was a lot of pain and control and manipulation that places like Teen Mania did. And I think it's so important to continue to critique those as they pop up because they're like whack-a-mole and they keep popping up here or there. And I think it's important that we look at our history and critique those spaces. And I can look at my friendships where I was sitting at brunch, we're drinking mimosas and we've had a lot of bullshit. And some of them still work in mega churches and some of them are no longer Christians. All of them are straight, but I'm sitting there with my boyfriend and we can share this space and hold it for what it is that, yeah, like we were absolutely traumatized. And it makes me think of The Glass Castle, where the memoir, The Glass Castle, where the writer could not understand that how could she appreciate her dad so much because he created some magic for her and he was an abuser. Mm. And I think both of those things can be true. I experienced some magic there in the sense of I was given purpose. I was given intense community. I was given value and like, wow, look at what you're offering. I was given confidence. Those things were magic that I got in this crucible of a space, and it was still a crucible that was causing harm. And so, yeah, I would say that nostalgia and there are some good things at the same time.
Yeah,
I'm curious where you went from Honor Academy to, you said YWAM. Did you go directly into a DTS or into YWAM out of Honor Academy?
So, because I wanted to stay at Teen Mania, obviously God's plan for me was to leave it. And so I took on that whole push-pull relationship with like desires and wants. That's one that's taken me a lot of time to recover. But I was offered a youth pastoring position back in Colorado Springs. I was really excited to get out of that space. And so again, of course I'll go back. And so went back, was a junior high pastor for 3 years as a 19 to 22 year old. Another whole on podcast episode could be like, why the heck do we use young people to teach one of the most at-risk populations and give them the least amount of training?
I was running youth programs at 18, 19 years old, which is absolutely wild to me that they let me do that.
I mean, it also makes sense because you've got the energy, you've got the zeal, and then they can also direct that zeal. I think that that's part of it. That's probably my cynicism coming up, but that is an easier person to maneuver rather than a 45-year-old individual who is like actually studied and taken time to form opinions that they can push back on. It would be my more cynical judgment of the situation.
Yeah.
So anyway, I did that for 3 years and then did YWAM. And then I would say that actually during YWAM slash towards the end of it, yeah, I would say the last like month or two, that's when I really was like, oh shit, I have to, what have I been a part of? What am I complicit in? Do I believe in this? Is there a God? Is everything I believed a lie? Like all of that started actually in YWAM, which I've actually been learning that is not an uncommon story. And I think it's because with the research that I've done around why people are leaving Christianity, exposure to difference is a huge moment for people to start questioning. And I think that YWAM indirectly is probably one of the biggest exposures for a lot of young, naive, zealous evangelical youths, where, you know, maybe they grew up in this tiny little town and they want to change the world for God. Of course, they'll become a missionary. They do YWAM and then they go to India and they're like, oh shit. What do I actually believe?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's literally what happened to me.
I think that there's also something about the extremity. Like, I often will tell people, like my story was getting involved in a very high control cult like church plant. And had I like gone to Bible college and like gotten a more of an average youth pastor job out of Bible college and had more of a moderate experience, I may have waited. I still think I probably would have gotten there to like the, I don't believe this, but like it probably could have taken me another 10 or 20 years. Yep. Whereas the extremity of a YWAM DTS or a, you know, a very intense church plant experience kind of like turns everything to 11 and makes you really question all of these things you're taking very seriously.
Yep. No, I absolutely agree with that. I, again, with some of that research of looking at why people are leaving, the amount of times I read a story of they went to get a master's in theology and then they like came to terms with what the Bible is, that it's not this holy book, and like they're getting exposed to these are gaps that we have or misalignments that we have, or like this is the actual story behind this book, and they're like, wait, I thought it was perfect, I thought it was this divine thing. And for that was the story I read a lot within my research, where it's just like, no, the people who are most zealous are typically the ones that took this thing so seriously that they're like, whether it be looking at the Bible and with a critical eye and they're like, shit, I can't believe in this anymore, or it was an I really think that while I am terrified for Trump to get back into presidency, I am grateful for his original presidency in the sense of it was a catalyst for so many people to look at that and be like, wait. The people I've been aligned with are aligning with this person and that person doesn't look like Jesus. What the hell happened?
I think it's the first time on this podcast that anybody has ever said they were grateful for the Trump presidency. So.
We're going to pull that one section and it's going to be just totally out of context quoted. Yeah. Brandon Flannery, listen to this episode. He's grateful for Trump's presidency. We'll get more downloads than any other episode ever.
I was going to say, you'll get some good clickbait. Yeah.
But I am curious. Okay. You talked briefly about never wanting to come out, and then now, you know, you're like living your full self, right? And so did you know from a very young age that you were gay and you just were closeted, or were you side B for like, what was that journey for you as you kind of in the mix of all of these different jobs that you had and this, and kind of your deconstruction experience?
Absolutely. I knew very young, and to kind of come back to that idea of I was really good. I was a poster child for evangelicalism, except for this one fucking thing that would just not let up. And so for a long time, I resented my sexuality for that very reason. I was like, man, everything else about me sits so well in this seat. But the one thing was, it was a big thing for that space. And again, like mentioning earlier, like seeing what happened to Ted Haggard and seeing what people were saying or not saying about LGBTQ people, I was very cognizantly aware of that this is the one thing that does not fit and I better not let anyone see. And the few times I did, it didn't go well. You know, at New Life, I had a youth group leader that tried to exorcise me. I had another elder that, like, once I shared, they lost, they were, like panicked and then ran off to get their wife because I guess they didn't feel like they could be around me, even though we're in this massive auditorium with
the Billy Graham rule applied to gay people. I've never seen that
apparently
before.
Apparently, so. Oh, so many of my relationships with people who stayed in that space, it was so weird because I was always like, I don't get the whole like purity culture thing. It's so stupid. I like hanging out with a girl in a car, but I was like, talked about that all the time. And then to see it applied to me with my guy friends, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not going to do anything. I literally at Teen Mania was cuddling men. Because I was told to, and I was fine. So the fact that men can't have any control over themselves is a bunch of bullshit because I'd be in like locker rooms where men were naked and I didn't sexually assault anyone. Like yeah. you can have control.
Well, and like, and I, as a person who has come out late in life and had a lot of explorative gay experiences, nothing has been as homoerotic as my experience at like Bible camp as a teenager.
And, oh my God!
Like
yeah.
it was homoerotic. Like we had naked
100%.
Night like every year yep. at our Bible camp, and we would like all be naked together. I mean, it was gay. There was nothing gayer than being in youth group for me.
I was always, no, I always joke that and say, like, if we are not born gay, evangelicalism is, like, making us. Like, what the spaces that they create.
Yeah.
So homoerotic. It was so weird. Like, at a very young age, like, seeing, yeah, like, going to youth camps and you would get extra points if, like, the guys would do weird shit together. Like,
yep.
So dumb.
So many similar experiences.
So, anyway, all that, so then, I started to become honest about who I was, but it was always attached to the language of same-sex attraction, and it was this thing to hopefully be cured, especially coming from charismatic spaces. What's terrifying about that space and that flavor of Christianity is that it can be delusional. Like, I've noticed with people that are still in that space that they have a hard time accepting reality because you don't want to believe that. That's not real. What you make things real by what you believe, by what you speak into existence, like that. A lot of those people would never say that they have name it and claim it mentality, but that they kind of do. It's just been rebranded. And so I know I was in that space of like, I'm going to believe for this. But I would also be very honest of like, I'm attracted to guys. I ended up dating a girl who, from YWAM, who knew I was attracted to men. But like, we got along so well, we're like, let's try it. And she was bisexual. And so she was just like, I get it. Like, women are beautiful. And so it wasn't until it reached a boiling point after she and I broke up. And we didn't break up for me to come out. But when we broke up, there was like this like loneliness that finally set in of I'm no longer in the church because I started questioning things. I lost a lot of my friends because they're connected to whether it be the church, the ministry, missions organizations, and also this deeper existential loneliness of I don't know what I believe. And if I've been doing this for God and I don't know if God is even there, then who fucking cares? And so that was, I explain it specifically in my book, like it was there for a very long time. And I use the analogy of a backdraft. I'm still haunted by that film. Like, I was such a little kid, but I remember people getting burned alive. I don't remember what happened. I just know that there's fire. Like, but I do remember like what a backdraft is. And like when a fire is about to die out from lack of oxygen, if it gets the tiniest crack of oxygen, it'll explode out. And that's how I described my sexuality. It was just like rampant to try to like, I've been starved for so long. And like went from virgin at 25, wouldn't like even was planning on giving virgin lips to my wife on the wedding day, which is really easy to do when you don't want to kiss them, to like 22 body. Like, I use the language of bodies because it was like that. I didn't really know the people. It was just having sex within like 2 to 3 months. And so then stumbled into a relationship, wasn't planning on that happening. And that's where really it started to solidify things of like, wait, what is wrong with this? And I feel like that was the kind of nail in the coffin for me of like, wait, I'm in this healthy relationship. It's a lot healthier than hooking up. It had its own problems and we're not together anymore. But like the question came up of what is actually wrong with loving someone? I don't get it. Like, why is this bad? And before then, I could label it as, well, of course, being gay is bad. Like, look at all the sex that I've had, and look at, you know, because queer people were demonized for me, it's like, oh, it's just about lust. It's not about love. And I had all these like excuses in my head to help me cope with not acting on my attractions and my sexual identity. And then what, I didn't have answers anymore for that, for those questions now in a relationship. So, I'm in the end, I'm grateful for my sexuality, because I think that I was getting a payoff from evangelicalism, to kind of use your words, Cortland. Like, I think that eventually I would have deconstructed, but my sexuality exaggerated it or expedited it. Mm-hmm. Because I had to, and I had to look at these verses, and I had to decide what I think, because there's a piece of me that didn't fit anymore that I couldn't keep silent. And what does that mean for me? And it made me question the Bible. It made me look at things more critically. It made me see how the system was not just harming me, but harming women, harming people of color. It has a political agenda. Like, it was just a domino effect, which any evangelical, I don't know why they would, listening to this would be like, and this is why you keep things in the closet. You don't try, because then it's just a downward spiral from there. But it was, I'm so grateful for my sexuality, because it forced me to come to terms with things that maybe I wouldn't have had the courage to, because I had to. So yeah, I'm really grateful for it.
Well, I want to hit on like this point. So I want to bring up a couple other podcasters in inspiring kind of this question here. There's a podcast mm-hmm. called We Were Christian Kids. A couple friends of mine who I grew mm-hmm. up with, Justin Randall and Calvin Arcedia, who I think they're not hosting it anymore, but great podcast. Go check those guys out. But Justin talked about in one of their episodes about, you know, he grew up in the church I mentioned earlier, and ended up then, you know, having a, you know, substance abuse, you know, situation, and then getting sober. And then this kind of like self-fulfilling, or this like kind of like shame spiral of like, oh, we were always told like, this is what happened. You get into the gay community, you start like hooking up with everyone, you start drinking, you start doing drugs, and this is why being gay is bad. And he's like, oh no, it's just because like, we are so traumatized by this institution that then set us out into the world and then blamed the way that we behaved on our sexuality. And so not to, again, slut shame anyone or, you know, whatever, but like, did you experience this, I guess, emotion about like, oh, now I'm embracing myself, but also there's this kind of like interior, like, oh, this is why they said being, because we can't have a relationship, because we have to, you know, we're these party, drug, sex crazed queer people. Did you have any of that internalized?
Yeah. No, 100%. It wasn't so much around like drug or sex. Like, I'm still like I don't know about that. But like, that wasn't like my vice, so to speak. And that feel like drugs and alcohol are very like, I don't have like a compulsive relationship to those things, but I did have a compulsive relationship to sex. I definitely internalized this homophobia inside of even a relationship, where I'm like, one of the reasons that this relationship fell apart is I would say things like, maybe we're not supposed to be gay, because at this point in my life, I'm like, because bottoming is horrible, and maybe all of us are just pretending to like this so that way we can like satisfy these desires, and like, we're just using each other. Next one would be like, next thing is like, what happens if we decide to adopt a girl? Who's going to tell her about a period? This is why we need heterosexual relationships, because someone needs to tell her about how her body works. I can't tell her how our body works. Like, I would create thing after thing after thing to try to hold on to this, like, I wouldn't say hold on to it, but like, there was a panic that was stirring underneath all of it, and I needed to come to terms with it, but then was terrified to, because it would blow up this relationship that I cared about. So it wasn't until we broke up that I could actually really stare at those questions. And I'm very grateful for places like Launchpad and With Collective, where I was encountering queer people who really loved Jesus and really loved, and like don't necessarily relate to the Bible as this perfect thing. And they're very progressive in a lot of their beliefs, but like, there's plenty of queer pastors in that space. And that was my first time experiencing that. Seeing this black lesbian pastor talk about how much she loves the Bible. And I'm just like, what the fuck is happening? And so while I don't quite live there, it was so helpful for me to see that there was a different option. I think I've heard this language before. I still hear it from people that I love, where that is where they will continue to say, isn't this bad? Because that space is so sexualized, because they're grooming children, because all you care about is sex. It takes over this identity. They have a long list of reasons as to why that I inherited. And I would agree, Cortland, where I think that so much of the queer experience is trauma-based. I think minority identities in general, a lot of those cultures are going to be reactive in nature because you're responding to an oppressive system. And so I think that in a lot of those spaces, we're having to unpack, like, what is, for me, like, what's me and what is my trauma? And so, like, for me, definitely, I think that one of my trauma reactions was I have so much shame because I feel like I'm still going to hell, even though I'm coming out of the closet, even though I don't want to believe that. And sex is a really good thing to make you feel good, you know? So for a long time, sex was this escapist coping skill where instead of coming to terms with who I was and the repercussions to that, sex was a great way for me to feel good, to feel connected, to get some identity, and to kind of pretend like the world didn't exist for a while. And so, yeah, I jumped from body to body to body. Beautiful book that it is dated in the sense of, I think that the writer assumes certain things about queer people that aren't necessarily true, especially in spaces that are more accepting and we're moving forward. So like, five steps back, but we like, in general, on the long term, like when we're looking at the long expanse of time, especially as the United States, like we're doing a lot better around this stuff where we have kids who are meeting their partners in high school and they're going to prom, you know, and it's not a big deal. And I think that what I'm seeing is a lot healthier choices from those individuals rather than living here in Atlanta. And, you know, I'm at a bar and there's an older gay man that is coming from rural Alabama and comes to Atlanta to have a drink or two. And he's just so desperate to have sex and then return and pretend like nothing's happening. And so I think that as we continue to heal this as a society, it makes me think of, ableism. And, you know, we could say like, well, isn't life so hard for someone in a wheelchair? It's like, well, what makes life hard for someone in a wheelchair is the fact that there's curbs everywhere and there's stairs. Like, it doesn't have to be difficult. The society that we've built is built for able-bodied people. That's why it's difficult. The reason it's difficult for queer people is because life has been built for heteronormative cis people. Like, that's the reason it's difficult. And the reason it's, and we don't have support and we don't have role models. They're, like, the list is endless as to why would you expect this population to have everything together when there's no support system? There's no major role models that, like, I found them, but especially when you're in evangelical spaces, who are you looking up to and who are you finding that you can kind of admire as a queer person? So now I found them, like, I had to dig through things and like find my own history, but it took time and it took healing and also working. Like, I'm now in a relationship of, I started in June, I think it's like 9 months now, where as a result of my choices and trauma around my trauma, choices around my trauma of using sex as an escape, it did damage on our relationship. So now a pendulum swing that I'm bumping into is around purity culture, where it's like, yeah, purity culture has done a number on us. And then I've also been over here and been a hoe. And like, I've seen how my relationship to sex, but on both sides of those extremes, had consequences. And I'm now finding a beautiful medium where I'm really excited and grateful for the sexual identity and life that I'm building, not only with myself but with my partner.
I have a question. Just, and you may not to put you to say that you have to have landed somewhere, because I don't, you know, yeah. I haven't. But I am really impacted by what you're saying about being able to see queer people of faith and being able to see, you know, with your Ted Haggard example, for instance, right? Like, there is this, like, oh, there is either people who leave the faith and get to pursue being queer, or people who just shove it down yeah. and keep being yeah. Christian and still suffer. Yeah. And likewise, you know, for myself, like, I identify as an atheist. I'm non-monogamous mm-hmm. and polyamorous. I am not sober. But I think it's really important for queer people of faith to exist, for monogamous people, mm-hmm. queer people to exist, for these yeah. other to so where do you find yourself forward. Like yeah. in that space in terms of that pendulum swing?
So the one, there's a couple identities that you pointed out, so I'll work through some of them. You said atheist. I would the idea of there being a God beyond is very helpful for me. I used to like live in a space where I'm like, ah, I don't think there's anything beyond that. But I've noticed that believing in something beyond that I've bumped into, and I do have a lot of stories where it feels like something beyond me was looking out for me or is benevolent at least towards me, has been helpful. And so I identify as an optimistic seeker who will never fully find the answers, but is so excited to learn from all the different options before me, religious wise. And so I'll attend a Quaker meeting like every like once a month, stuff like that. It's been a really healing and lovely place. When it comes to my sexual identity, I would say that I am definitely gay, and I am cis. When it comes to my relationship formula framework, I would say that it's so loose, in the sense of I don't need that one to be identified. I don't need to identify as monogamous. I don't need to identify as polyamorous. I just like getting rid of all those things. I love so many things that my polyamorous friends have taught me around how one person is not my everything and is not my Prince Charming. And it is unfair for them to literally satisfy all these different intimacies that I need, intellectual, spiritual, sexual, which there's so many, and to expect those from one person is unfair. And so there are elements of polyamory that I carry with me in that regard. But I get to build a relationship that serves both me and my partner, is how I currently exist. I think that monogamy was this huge idol that I inherited from evangelicalism, and that even when I left evangelicalism, I would get so pissed when I'd run into queer people who are either in open relationships or polyamorous relationships, being like, "Gah, every single one! Don't you have get enough with your partner? Like, why do you have to why do you have to be selfish?" And so, like, would get so frustrated, and because it was still this idol that not only I got from evangelicalism, but like Disney and Hollywood and so many other spaces. And moving to Atlanta has been this beautiful space of like, I get a blank slate and I get to build what I want. And so when I first came here, I had no framework that I wanted to inherit. I wanted to build something scratch. So when my boyfriend and I started dating, I have been, very open and have like explored polyamory and stuff like that. But when we got together, I said, we need to go to the common denominator of who needs what when it comes to how restricted our relationship is, because I am very base level right now, and we can build whatever shelter that is going to cultivate respect for both of us and trust for both of us. We need to kind of have very open and direct conversations around what do we want. And so while monogamy had come off the podium, that is something that he wanted. And I was like, we'll see. But if it serves us, great. And if it stops serving us, let's analyze it, because we don't need to inherit that. What's been really beautiful that I've loved about monogamy as of such with my relationship is I remember the first time that I got stressed at work And stress is a trigger for me where I want sex. And my natural reaction would be to pull up Grindr and find as quick as I can anyone that's willing to have sex to help me cope with the stress that I'm feeling. Because I was in this monogamous relationship, I was like, fuck, I have to express this need.
Oh, no, you have to communicate to your partner? No!
Yeah. Yeah, fuck! Like, I don't want to be vulnerable. And so, like, I remember texting him and being like, hey, like, I'm super stressed right now at work. This would be my natural reaction. I would really like to have sex with you and just be very, like, vulnerable. And, like, he could say no. Instead, he was just like, I love that you're sharing this with me. And we've been able to, like, it instigated intimacy. So at present, monogamy is serving us. But, like, ultimately, whatever relational house we choose to build and what boundaries we create, because, like, when we first started, it was even more open where he was going off to P-Town. And he was like, I'm going off with friends and I want to dance with people and kiss people because you're not going to be there. I'm like, great. Let's have that be our boundary. When we go out dancing, we can kiss people. We can dance with people. I would like to cuddle with people. I took that from evangelicalism. I'm not getting rid of it. And so, like those, we don't need to be hard or nothing. We get to build what serves us. And it's been really beautiful to do with him.
I love that because I was just having a conversation with somebody about why does it have to be a binary, like either monogamous or non-monogamous. And because I feel like what it comes down to, and essentially what you're saying, is it comes down to the relationship agreements that you have with your partner. And so it's like, what may look non-monogamous to one couple might be monogamous to somebody else. And so like, why even, what use does that label have if what it comes down to is what relationship agreement you have with the person that you're in relationship with? So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, let's imagine that you have, you married someone and, it comes out later that the other person's like really hates sex and like really is maybe more asexual in nature, but now you have these kids, you love doing life together, but there's this element of your life that you cannot serve each other, especially if the other person is sexual. Why can't we be more creative with our solutions of like, okay, like you have this family that you're building and this is beautiful that you guys have that together. Why do we need to disrupt that? Like, could you date someone? Like, if you're wanting that one-on-one emotional intimacy, maybe you have a partner where you're going to have that, you have a more sexual relationship and you have this family, or you just open up the relationship. If it's not so much you need that emotional connection, maybe you go off and you have hookups. Like, I think love looks like, how can we serve each other? Like, how can, again, build a relational house that doesn't need to be inherited like a blueprint, but something that we could build from scratch. Cause ultimately we live in this home. No one else does.
And I think to your point, Brandon, about the world being built, that illustration about ableism and the structures that we're living in is very apt. And one of the reasons why there's so much panic around gender and around, you know, all the kids being bisexual these days, and, you know, like everyone, because it's like, oh man, we don't know where to put people, what boxes to put people in. And therefore, we can't be prescriptive about telling people how to behave. And I think that is something we're seeing a big revolution of, like, on all sides, right? Like we can't be gatekeeping our genders anymore. We can't be gatekeeping queerness anymore. We can't be gatekeeping in these areas, because we are not a monolith, right? There is not a single perfect representation of this given identity that anyone might hold. I love how you're kind of illustrating this openness to being able to say, like, well, what serves me, and also, like, what serves me now versus it might change.
Yep.
That would have been terrifying to me.
It comes full circle. Can I tell the story of why we Zoomed for the first time? Do you remember? No? Brandon, you don't remember?
Oh, sorry. I wasn't sure who it was directed towards.
No, that's fine. No.
I remember the first time Megan and I Zoomed. It was because she was like, I really want to host a podcast with you. Then we had to keep it a secret for a minute. Anyway, that's our story.
It was about polyamory. Do you remember?
Yeah. Oh, I had
read a blog post that you had written about non-monogamy, mm-hmm. and I was like, I have questions about this because my co-host of my podcast is non-monogamous, and he got on a Zoom, and I love that because I can see how you've evolved. Not that, I mean, we got on a Zoom and you talked about some of the things you just mentioned where like everyone was just kind of like, well, if you're queer, you have to be polyamorous. And you were like, I kind of want to push back on that a little bit.
And you can't be Christian and you can't be sober and you can't, which is such bullshit. Sorry.
And it was so good because it was in a conversation. And I feel like so much of social media, and we didn't even know each other, but so much of social media is like, I disagree, fuck this, you know, like, you know, cancel you and write you off. But it was like, hey, can we have a conversation about this? And we realized that we lined up and had a lot of agreement, even though there was a question that I had about something you had written. And so it's amazing to see the rest of that conversation now.
Well, and I would say not even rest of conversation. I think that it's, I am so grateful that we don't have to be slaves to our past, because I would say I've even evolved from that conversation that we had, Megan, where I think that I was trying to still make monogamy this more valuable thing, because that language was, I definitely put it as a commodity, and I was using a lot of like Marxist language and abstraction and stuff like that. And so like, I think it was a very hoity-toity way of saying like, I think it's more valuable. And so I remember that blog post in particular caused a lot of conversation, which I'm grateful for, because it brought me into contact with more people who are different than me. One of my friends has found herself in a polyamorous relationship. It was the first time she had done it, and she left evangelicalism like years before, and she read it and got pissed. But then she went to her partner, and her partner was assigned male at birth, and is attracted. Earlier in their life, they were attracted to men. That's changed now. And so they were sharing with her that was their experience in gay spaces, where it seemed like everyone was just trying to hook up. There wasn't this like commitment anymore. And that it was a frustration that they held while living in that space. And so that's where it's like, there's nuance. Like, I just because something works for me and serves me and my partner doesn't mean that it serves someone else. And it doesn't mean that it serves us in 5 years. Maybe it will. Again, it's no longer an idol where I need this to be the case, but I do love what it's producing in our relationship. And so as long as it's serving both of us, I'm going to keep it. And that's what's beautiful with me now is like, I like with evangelicals, we have to hold on. I found the right answer. I don't believe in right answers anymore. I like, that's another framework thing where it's like, no, I don't think any of us have the right answers. I think a lot of us have different answers that serve us for different times and different places. And for the time, this is an answer that is serving both of us for this time. And it doesn't control me, but rather it's the other way around. It serves me. And as soon as it stops doing that, then it should be analyzed. And not to be selfish, but like, that's something that, again, intimacy, if that were to ever change, now I have to have another intimate conversation with my partner and share my desires and wants and create solutions that's going to serve each other and respect each other.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So much of it boils down to like the willingness to have maybe scary conversations or uncomfortable conversations. Yep.
Yes. That's one thing I love about queer relationships is we don't get a blueprint.
Mm.
And preach. As a result, I think there's a lot of resentment that occurs over a long period of time in straight relationships because they don't have conversations as much as queer people. Not necessarily, but like a luxury, but also a cost of heterosexual relationships is you could assume a lot, because there's a lot of blueprints that you're handed. From the moment I talk to another person, we have to have conversations around who wants what and what do things look like from the get-go. a lot of my straight relationships, friends that are in straight relationships, they bump into it later and they realize, oh, wait, we could talk about this. Mm-hmm. But so often they just put on the clothes they were given and the roles that they were given without question until they start, till they're too small or they're itching. And then at some point, maybe they explode on their partner when really they could have had a conversation a lot sooner and there wouldn't be this built up resentment as a result of the blueprints that we've inherited.
Mm. That is so good.
Yeah, and I know we're getting to time, but I want to hear a little bit about your book too, and make sure we get that plugged and talk about that whole process, and so we can make sure our listeners know where to order it, where to read your full story.
Yes. So my book is called Stumbling, a sassy memoir about coming out of evangelicalism. It's with Lake Drive Books. I really love working with them. It's been a whirlwind of an adventure to get that published. In short, it is me poking fun at trauma of deconstruction and the answers that I have found, not the answer, but some answers that I have found on the other side. So I learn from story personally. So I use little snippets in time throughout my journey that shifted something inside of me, whether that was blowing the house down, so to speak, that I was living in of evangelicalism, to like some bricks that I've been finding to rebuild. It's about grief. It's about queerness. It's about sex. And all along the way, I try to, with my humor, kind of be sincere yet sarcastic of poking at the ridiculousness that it is to be in this space of leaving evangelicalism and in evangelicalism and being queer and all these other identities that I carry. The very first chapter opens up with the fact that my friend's death was another key moment for me, because I think that I was beginning to trust that there might be a God at some point in my life. And then he died all of a sudden. I think it's the case for a lot of people. It's not a new story in that regard. And that's one thing I've been discovering is like, so many of my friends I never imagined picking this up, who are maybe still Christian, they're straight, are reading it. And I think that there are some things like death that we can all relate to. There are questions like, what the hell just happened when we pray for someone, nothing happens? And what does that look like? What does it mean to doubt? What does it mean to have conflict with our friends and family that we've built a life with? So those are all kind of the messy questions that I deal with in the memoir.
Yeah.
Awesome. And also Lake Drive Books is one of our sponsors for our content warning event that we have coming up.
Woo-hoo! They're great. We're big fans.
I love them.
Maybe
they're
we can get David to bring a few copies of your book out to our event to sell.
So that'd be fun. Yeah. Coming up. He should.
Yeah. He'll be bringing books. So
good.
That'd awesome.
So go out and get a copy of Stumbling. Get your local bookstore to order it. Get your local library to order it. We're big promoters in finding any reason to buy a book from an author we get to have here. So hopefully folks will click the links in the show notes and do that. If there is a social media, we're all on like 97 social medias these days. If there's one that's like, this is where I'm most active, this is where I'm most engaged with, you know, people who are following and looking for book number two, what is it, and how can people find you there?
Yeah, my handles across, I want to say most platforms, is Flan Bran. Just imagine like an old person cereal. I would say Instagram is probably the one that I've been gravitating around the most. I was on TikTok for a hot second, and it just feels a little bit like a dumpster fire lately for some reason. I don't know what happened. It brought me so much joy, and now it is just chaos. And so Instagram is definitely more of the space that I live on these days. So, and then also BrandonFlannery.com. You can get a lot of my long form writing there, because I do journalistic pieces and stuff like that. So you can find stuff there as well.
Awesome.
Nice.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for having me. This was a great conversation.
It's been so good. We cannot wait to have you back, and really grateful that you took the time to hang out with us today.
Absolutely.
All right. That was so good.
It was.
He's delightful.
I really enjoyed that conversation. For lots of different reasons, but I love how much nuance and how much like just like this like vibe and this like air of like we're still figuring this stuff out and and holding space and grace for people as they figure this stuff out and sort through the different aspects of trauma that all of us have been handed in different ways, going through the experiences that we have. So huge shout out to Brandon. And I hope everyone who's listening runs to social media to follow him in all the places and hopefully to your local bookstore to order his book and to the library. Maybe both. You go to the local bookstore and go to your library and see if they can put it on order for you there so that future people could check it out and get access to it as well.
Awesome. Well, where can people find you, Cortland, and the podcast?
Yeah, I'm at Cortland Coffee, all the places. I'm trying to be on Instagram primarily these days. I'm back on Twitter. I'm back on like a habit I can't kick, like a half smoked pack of cigarettes that just keeps lying around waiting to be finished. Twitter, you know, there's just so many beautiful, wonderful, amazing people that I know on there. So I'm on there as well. And so is the pod. Thereafter Podcast on Instagram and Threads, Thereafter Pod on Twitter, patreon.com/thereafterpod if you're looking to join the Patreon. Megan, what about you?
I am at The Pursuing Life. I actually gave that as my, because it's my email address at my email address is thepursuinglife@gmail.com. Now everybody knows you can email me everything.
Email Megan,
but,
all the things. Don't sign her up for though. Please don't go sign her up for emails.
I gave it to somebody at Content Warning and they said, that sounds really evangelical. And it's funny because it was something that I carried through deconstruction, The Pursuing Life. It was pre and post and it still fits. I feel like I'm still constantly pursuing a lot of different things. But anyway, The Pursuing Life, Instagram, Twitter. Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I can't give it up. I just can't. I guess I'm on Threads sometimes. And then check us out in Clubhouse on Tuesday mornings, 6 a.m. Pacific time and other times in other time zones.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's it for us. We've got a lot more incredible interviews in the hopper ready to get out to y'all, so keep checking back. We're typically here with new episodes every Tuesday, so we can't wait for you to join us again for whatever comes next.
Until next time.
Until then.